Thank you for tuning in to the WOLA Podcast, Latin America Today, and the Just the Facts Podcast. It's Friday, July 26, 2013. I'm Adam Isaacson, Senior Associate for Regional Security Policy here at WOLA. Let's take a look at the week ahead. I'm going to focus here on the Pope's visit to Brazil in the wake of mass protests, a new report on Colombia's conflict and the difficult effort to end it, and a wave of violence creating a dilemma for Mexico's president. First, Brazil, where Pope Francis is in the latter stages of a week-long visit to the country. It's the first foreign trip for the Catholic Church's first Latin American pope. Francis, the former Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio, is from Argentina. He's visiting a country that's preparing to host two other events, the 2014 World Cup and the 2016 Olympics. Brazil's still figuring out things like security and logistics for big events. It's also a country that's just been through a month of massive protests as citizens' anger at corruption and poor government services has been boiling over. Securing the Pope's visit has been an issue. 10,000 police and more than 14,000 soldiers have been deployed to protect Francis, who likes to go outside his security perimeter and mingle with the people. On the first day of his visit, the Pope's Fiat car appeared to take a wrong turn and ended up mobbed by spectators on a crowded street. Brazilian authorities have been criticized for allowing that to happen, but ultimately, they admit that they can only provide so much security in the middle of one of the world's largest cities. Certainly, Brazil's approach to large event security is more relaxed than we would become accustomed to in the United States. General Presidential Secretary Gilberto Carvalho said, "Much of the Pope's security will be provided by the Brazilian people themselves." It's hard to imagine a U.S. official saying something like that. And just weeks before Francis's arrival, the Brazilian people themselves had just been taking to the streets in the millions in protests that engulfed nearly every city in the country. The June demonstrations began with a protest over a rise in bus fares, but after those initial marches were met with a brutal police response, they mushroomed into a larger, more general outpouring of discontent. Brazilians are angry about corruption. According to a recent poll by Transparency International, 81% of Brazilians think the country's political parties are corrupt, including the ruling Workers' Party, which is a leftist party that suffered several big corruption scandals. 72% think the country's Congress is corrupt. Brazilians are also angry at the quality of government services in a country that collects more taxes as a percentage of the economy than nearly every other Latin American country. They're also angry at the high cost to taxpayers of hosting the World Cup and the Olympics. And they're increasingly angry at a downturn in Brazil's economy. You may remember Brazil getting a lot of very positive media coverage back in 2009 and 2010 when its economic growth was as fast as 7.5% a year. Well, that number is now barely above zero. Economists forecast Brazil's economic growth to average about 2.1% per year during the four-year term of President Dilma Rousseff, which ends next year. That'll be the lowest average growth for a Brazilian presidency since that of disgraced President Fernando Collor, who resigned amid a corruption scandal in 1992. So more than a million Brazilians marched over a couple of weeks last month in mostly peaceful protests. A recent poll from Brazil's Transportation Association, which takes regular polls seen as credible, showed 84% of Brazilians approving of the protests. Now, these protests have since died down, though about 2,000 demonstrators gathered outside the governor's palace in Rio de Janeiro on Monday, the first day of the Pope's visit. These protests became violent when a Molotov cocktail was hurled at the police, and the police then charged at the crowd. Brazilian social media lit up with speculation that the Molotov cocktail was thrown not by a protester but by a police infiltrator among the protesters. The police denied that, but admitted that they were placing undercover agents among the crowds. Pope Francis has not directly mentioned the protests in his public remarks in Brazil, though Spain's El País newspaper reported earlier this month that he had privately said that they were just and coherent with the gospel. In Brazil, the Pope has been less direct but still rather blunt. He's spoken several times about the issues that inspired the protests. While visiting a favela in Rio de Janeiro on Thursday, Francis urged the crowd never to yield to discouragement in the fight against corruption, and he criticized the, quote, the culture of selfishness and individualism among elites in one of the world's most economically unequal countries and called for a greater commitment to the poor. A day earlier, the Pope talked drug policy. He condemned Latin America's narco-traffickers, and he came out strongly against those in the region, Latin America, who would loosen prohibitions on illegal drugs. In the Pope's words, "A reduction in the spread and influence of drug addiction will not be achieved by a liberalization of drug laws." It'll be interesting to see if these comments have a cooling effect on the politics surrounding drug policy reform in Latin America, especially in Uruguay, where the Congress there is close to debating a plan to regulate legal marijuana use. Instead of changing drug laws, the Pope endorsed a much slower approach, that of creating greater social justice for the poor and expanding economic opportunities for young people. Even as he meets with poor favela residents and names the problems that led to the June protests, Pope Francis is also conspicuously meeting with the political class in Brazil, the same politicians who are the targets of the politicians' anger, or rather of the protesters' anger. These include members of the ruling Workers' Party. This party saw several of its top politicians, like former aides to ex-president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, found guilty last year in a scandal called the mensalão, or monthly payment. While these officials have been given prison sentences, none of them has actually gone to jail yet, and some of them are still in their seats in Congress. Meanwhile, leaders of the Congress have continued to appear way out of touch with the popular mood. They've been called out in recent weeks for using official aircraft, even as the protests were going on, to take them and their entourages to soccer games and family weddings. The anger at Brazil's politicians is reflected in the poll numbers showing a sharp drop in President Rousseff's popularity, which had been very high in spite of the country's economic slowdown. The CNT poll found her personal approval rating dropped from 74% in June to 49% in July. Before the protests, 54% of Brazilians said that they would vote to re-elect Rousseff when Brazil votes again in October 2014. In the most recent poll, though, only 33% said that they would vote for her. The good news for President Rousseff, for now at least, is that nobody in Brazil's opposition is doing any better. No other leader has been able to capitalize on the discontent in the country. Let's turn to Colombia, where a new government report is showing the huge human cost of the country's long internal armed conflict, and where the road toward a negotiated end to that conflict remains really bumpy. Since 1958, 220,000 Colombians have been killed, more than 80% of them civilians. There were 1,982 massacres just since 1980. Of those whose authorship can be identified, 17% were committed by guerrillas, 8% directly by the government security forces, and 59% by pro-government paramilitary groups. 5.7 million people in a country of about 47 million were forcibly displaced by violence. 27,023 people were kidnapped, mainly by guerrillas. 10,189 people were killed or maimed by landmines, the majority laid by guerrillas. These horrific numbers come from Enough Already, Memories of War and Dignity, a 434-page report by the Center for Historical Memory. This is an independent government commission that two different laws have charged with documenting what happened during Colombia's conflict. The report, I highly recommend it if you read Spanish. It's available online. Here's a shortened web address, bit.ly/12ZFQ, and I'll include it in the show notes for the podcast. The report's not just a compilation of statistics. It tells the story of the conflict, breaking it up into phases and going deeply into the causes for the violence. It notes that the most violent phase of the conflict was between the mid-1990s and the mid-2000s, and it includes numerous testimonies from victims, trying hard to put the victims themselves, who've really been invisible during most of the conflict, front and center in the narrative. At the launch of the report on Wednesday, President Juan Manuel Santos said, "We have to recognize that we've hit bottom and that the war has become dehumanized, and it has dehumanized us." He acknowledged as, quote, "uncomfortable truths," the report's revelations of police and military involvement in abuses. The coordinator of the Center for Historical Memory was Gonzalo Sanchez, one of the country's most respected scholars. He said, "The only way to end this horror is to consolidate a peace process. That's the only way to stop it." Now, there is a peace process underway in Colombia, of course. The dialogues between Colombia's government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC guerrillas, the largest guerrilla group, that started in Havana, Cuba, in October. These talks have made some progress. At the end of May, the government and guerrillas reached agreement on the first of five agenda points, a difficult one, land and rural development. But that was 2 months ago, and the second agenda point, which is political participation for guerrillas and the opposition, has been moving slowly. There have been two 10-day rounds of talks on this next topic, And these have mostly consisted of the two negotiating teams meeting separately in Havana. The next round, which is supposed to start really getting into the substantive issues, is to start on Sunday, the 28th of July. They were to start on the 22nd, but both sides announced a six-day delay for a variety of mainly logistical reasons. This slow pace, though, is making it pretty evident that the FARC talks aren't going to be over by November, which was the deadline that President Santos had suggested in public remarks several months ago. This is not a hard and fast deadline, and last week President Santos seemed to be backing off of it. He said he doesn't favor, quote, fatal dates. But it is the month when the president has to announce whether he will seek re-election for Colombia's May 2014 presidential vote, which is likely he will. After that, the country goes into campaign mode, though, and the political climate for the talks is going to get complicated. Though the talks are complicated already, that the negotiations on the political participation agenda topic seem to be bogged down by disagreement over what can and cannot be discussed, what's within the ground rules of the agenda. The government wants to talk about guarantees for the opposition, things like security so that ex-FARC can participate in politics and access to the media. The FARC seem to think this is an opportunity to remake the political system, holding a constitutional convention, Asamblea Constituyente, to rewrite Colombia's basic law. The guerrillas argue that this is what happened when the last time a major guerrilla group demobilized in 1990 and 91, when the M19 guerrillas, a smaller group than the FARC, played a central role in helping draft a new constitution. The government says this is out of the question, as there'd be no point in agreeing to something at the negotiating table if a constitutional convention would then come up with a whole different set of reforms, maybe on other issues. There's also the chance that a constitutional convention could reverse whatever gains the FARC make at the negotiating table. Now, the guerrillas are very unpopular in Colombia because of their attacks on the population for so many years. The right wing in Colombia continues to have a pretty strong following, maybe not a majority, but a strong following, and would probably stand to get many more of its representatives elected to a constitutional convention than the FARC would. These representatives could wipe out the FARC's agenda at a constitutional convention, so it's not clear why the FARC are pushing for this. But this issue has the dialogue stuck right now. Events away from the negotiating table are also posing challenges to the talks. Last weekend, on Colombia's Independence Day, July 20th, the FARC carried out its biggest attack in a long time, I think years, on a military target, at least measured by death toll. About 60 to 80 FARC fighters ambushed an army detachment that was protecting oil pipeline work in Fortul in Arauca department, not far from the Venezuelan border. They killed 15 of the soldiers, most of them apparently while they were already disarmed, according to witnesses, and if so, that would be a serious violation of international humanitarian law. Also, that day, July 20th, the guerrillas killed four more soldiers in Donceyo, in the south central department of Caquetá. Attacks like these hurt public support for the peace talks, but, you know, they're to be expected when the talks take place without a ceasefire in place. The Colombian government has refused a cessation of hostilities, which is something the FARC have been asking for. There are reasons why this makes sense. It means the negotiators in Havana have to talk about substantive topics and not just waste time accusing each other of violating ceasefire terms. But it also gives the guerrillas a strong incentive to appear strong at the negotiating table. It gives them a reason to show they aren't near defeat by carrying out headline-grabbing attacks on the battlefield, such as a major ambush on Independence Day. Another external issue that's affecting the peace talks is the continuing small farmer protests in the Catatumbo region, north of Arauca, and also near the Venezuelan border. I discussed these in last week's Week Ahead podcast. There have been no resolution at all to these at times violent protests, where protesters are calling for, more than 10,000 of them, are calling for a halt to aerial herbicide spraying in coca growing areas and for a special reserve zone to protect small farmers' land holdings. President Santos and other Colombian politicians have complicated things for the protesters by charging that they've been infiltrated by guerrilla groups. The FARC made it even more complicated this week by putting out a statement offering military support to the Catatumbo protesters. Quote, "They can count on our ranks, on our weapons, on our fighters," the FARC said on Monday. "We are ready to receive them, to support them, and guide them to final victory." As you can imagine, this offer is likely to affect the atmosphere at the negotiations in Havana. Even more likely to impact the negotiations is the guerrillas' announcement a week ago that they're holding an American hostage. U.S. citizen Kevin Scott Soute, a 26-year-old veteran of the Afghanistan War, had decided in June that he wanted to walk alone through Colombia's jungles from the town of San Jose de Guaviare in south-central Colombia, 300 miles east to the Venezuelan border. He embarked on his trip over the advice of just about everyone he talked to in San Jose de Guaviare, including the local police. Soute didn't make it very far. According to a FARC statement issued last Friday, they caught him about one county away in the jungle near El Retorno, Guaviare. The guerrilla statement offers to release Suté as a goodwill gesture to a committee made up of the International Committee of the Red Cross, the San Egidio Community, a Vatican organization that mediates conflicts, and former Senator Piedad Córdoba, a politician who in the past has helped to coordinate the guerrilla's unilateral hostage releases. Contacts between the FARC and the Red Cross have already begun for coordinating Suté's release, but President Santos may be slowing things down by refusing the FARC's condition that Senator Córdoba be present at the handover, recalling that the FARC pledged in February 2012 to halt the practice of kidnapping. President Santos angrily said, "These gentlemen of the FARC, violating in a flagrant way the commitment they made at the start of peace talks, are holding hostage a North American citizen." He said that neither Senator Córdoba nor any other public figure should be present at the handover because he did not want the FARC to be able to take advantage of Suté's release to get any media attention. There's no word yet on whether the FARC will release Suté if Piedad Córdoba is not present. If they decide to keep holding the American, they will be violating one of the government's main preconditions for the talks, that they not hold civilians captive, and the government will be likely to get up from the table. We'll have to see what happens. Meanwhile, Venezuela's government participates in the FARC process as a so-called accompanying country, and Venezuela, under the late President Hugo Chavez, is widely acknowledged to have played an instrumental role in convincing the FARC that it was time to start talks. But relations between the Colombian and Venezuelan governments have been chilly since the end of May, when President Santos angered President Nicolas Maduro by meeting with the head of the opposition, Enrique Capriles. Capriles had just narrowly lost Venezuela's presidential election to Maduro a month earlier, and he had not recognized and still does not recognize the result of that election. Still, President Santos had him in Bogota at the presidential palace and had a picture taken of them shaking hands. For a time in early June, the Venezuelan government's reaction to the Santos-Capriles meeting was so strong that Venezuela's support for the FARC peace talks was in doubt. But President Santos and Maduro appeared to have papered things over. They met on Monday in the remote Venezuelan border town of Puerto Ayacucho for what was reportedly a friendly exchange. They agreed to establish high-level diplomatic groups to coordinate discussions on security, energy, and trade, and Maduro assured Santos that Venezuela continued to support the FARC peace talks fully. Quote, "We are at your orders to contribute even modestly so Colombia can celebrate peace sooner than later," Maduro said. Finally, over to Mexico, which has seen one of the most violent weeks of President Enrique Peña Nieto's nearly eight-month-old administration. The violence comes a week after the arrest of Miguel Ángel Treviño, the leader of the feared Zetas criminal organization. However, most of the violence, not all of it, but most of it, took place in areas with little or no Zetas presence. The main area I'm talking about is Michoacán in west-central Mexico. This state here, in this state, two criminal groups are fighting each other and fighting Mexico's security forces, which have deployed there in large numbers. At least 42 people have been killed in Michoacán in the past week in several episodes of open combat. Now, the Knights Templar are a drug trafficking organization who are the direct descendants of the Familia Michoacana cartel, which sort of faded out when its leader, Nazario Moreno, was apparently killed in December 2010. Both the Familia and the Knights Templar have been known for a sort of a cult-like pseudo-religious ideology and for engaging in crimes like kidnapping and extortion that directly harm citizens who aren't involved in the drug trade. In much of Michoacán, especially in a farming region called the Tierra Caliente, the group is more powerful and more present than the government itself. In some parts of Michoacán, citizens have organized self-defense militias to try to protect themselves from the criminals. Some of these militias, though, are funded and organized by rival cartels, so it's really complicated. In May, President Peña Nieto sent thousands of army troops and federal police to try to wrest control of Michoacán from the Knights Templar. At the time, a lot of observers noted that sending troops to Michoacán was one of the first steps that Peña Nieto's predecessor, President Felipe Calderón, took after he began his term in December 2006. Unlike Calderón, Peña Nieto has been trying to de-emphasize security and violence in the government's narrative about what's going on in Mexico. He said he wants to try a different approach to public security, but the Michoacán military deployment looked like déjà vu. And just like in Calderón's time, so far at least, the deployment has not reduced violence in Michoacán. On Tuesday, the Knights Templar launched a series of six coordinated ambushes against police patrols. The government said that two police officers died, 15 were wounded in the shootouts that ensued, and that they killed 20 of the attackers. On Wednesday, a seventh ambush happened near the port city of Lázaro Cárdenas, killing two more officers. This comes after an attack on Monday, when gunmen opened fire on self-defense militia members in the town of Los Reyes, killing five people. and last Friday when four bodies were found hanging at the entrance of a town in Buena Vista, Tomatlan municipality. A day before that, three police were killed and six wounded in an ambush on a highway near Michoacán's border with Guerrero State. Now, this is not Zeta's territory, so there's no apparent tie to the arrest of Miguel Ángel Treviño. The fight in Michoacán involves the Knights Templar, the security forces, and a second criminal group calling itself the New Generation Jalisco Cartel. Jalisco is the state immediately to the west of Michoacán. The capital is Guadalajara. The New Generation is trying to bill itself as a less violent alternative to the Knights Templar, more purely dedicated to narco-trafficking only, and not engaging in kidnapping and extortion. In a video that they put out in late May showing about 50 members of the cartel wearing masks and carrying assault rifles, a New Generation voiceover says, "We are proud to say that we are a cartel, but we don't kidnap people or extort money from them, and that is why we're asking President Enrique Peña Nieto to leave us alone and let us do our work." While the Mexican government hasn't quite openly declared this as a policy, it's evident that, at least since the latter phase of the Calderón administration, it has been devoting most of its law enforcement energy and resources to confronting the most violent criminal groups. Groups that traffic drugs without generating as much violence maybe don't get left alone, but they're definitely feeling less pressure from the security forces. The New Generation appears to realize this and is openly trying to convince the government to leave it alone in exchange for good behavior. That may be a more smart strategy for the cartel, except by declaring it so publicly in videos, etc., it practically dares the government to go after them just to prove that it doesn't tolerate any drug traffickers, violent or not. And indeed, a leader of the New Generation, Victor Hugo Delgado, was arrested in Jalisco in mid-July. Michoacán isn't the only part of Mexico that saw alarming violence this week. The bodies of six men were found in a rural village in the border state of Chihuahua. In another border state, Coahuila, 18 people were killed in the capital of Saltillo last weekend, and hitmen dressed as doctors killed two men in a health clinic in Torreón. In the northern state of Durango, 11 people killed over the weekend. In Jalisco last Saturday, in a 12-hour period, in Guadalajara alone, seven people were killed. This is all putting a lot of pressure on President Enrique Peña Nieto, who has been trying hard not to let his presidency get consumed by the issue of violence. But he's so far focused much more on messaging than on actual strategic changes. Officials announced this week, in fact, that they will be sending an additional 2,000 soldiers and police to Michoacán, another echo of what President Calderón did at the beginning of his administration. The Peña Nieto government has been trying not to talk about crime and violence. Notice, for instance, how Miguel Ángel Treviño, the Zetas leader, has not been paraded in front of reporters, and that it wasn't the president who announced his capture or even really commented on it much. The Mexican government is claiming that its statistics show a drop in organized crime-related homicides in most months now to under 1,000. Critics, of course, question whether they're just reclassifying more existing murders as not related to organized crime than were classified that way before. Either way, bloody weeks like this one are going to make it difficult for President Peña Nieto to change the narrative because they make it apparent that Mexico really hasn't put its violence problems behind it. What's happening in Michoacán clearly contradicts this talk of success, that they know how to do it, that they have the answers. That's what security analyst Jorge Chabot of the Mexico City think tank CIDE told the Los Angeles Times. He continued, "This is a problem that goes beyond who is president. The problem isn't the strategy. The problem is the state, that the Mexican state doesn't work." In a column for Bloomberg News, Alejandro Ope, a former intelligence official, said, "Peña Nieto's administration is caught between saying so much that fear is reignited and saying so little that it appears insensitive to the very serious threats still facing many Mexicans. That dilemma is likely to linger or worsen over the week and the weeks ahead." And that's it for now. Thank you for listening to WOLA's Latin America Today and the Just the Facts podcast. Please keep listening. We're up on iTunes. Or if you have a moment to write a review, we'd really appreciate the feedback. And that when you do that, it helps us a lot to reach more new listeners. Meanwhile, please keep listening and visiting WOLA's website, www.wola.org, and the Just the Facts website at www.justf.org. If you're finding these podcasts useful, please do consider making a donation to keep us going. You can also find both WOLA and Just the Facts on Facebook or on Twitter. Twitter, we're at WOLA_ORG and just F_ORG. Thank you.